Welcome to East Meets West, episode 147. I'm Tom Merritt.
And I am a tired and somewhat half-awake Roger.
I have been sleeping all day, myself.
I didn't actually get up till 11:30.
That's good.
So, we were at CES in
Las Vegas.
Can't
tell by the tone of exhaustion in our voices, we were at CES. The Consumer Electronics Show, if you don't know what that is.
Where the biggest, and sometimes the brightest, not always, companies, vendors, marketeers, PR folks, and general hanger-ons come around and look at what supposedly will be on store shelves.
Hangers-on.
Come around and see what will or might be on sale either in 2009.
We were talking about that actually in the CNET coverage, kind of post-mortem.
Post-mortem?
Yeah, you know, when you kind of review how the coverage went afterwards.
Yes.
Next year we should do a story about what actually goes on at CES, which is the trade show portion of it, which is the retailers making the deals with the vendors.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really the main engine. There's lots of other stuff that happens at CES,
yes.
Believe me, but that is the kind of core purpose.
Well, the core purpose and what CES was always about was marrying the vendors, the creators, the producers, the shippers of the product, that being, you know, TVs, DVDs, electronic components, any kind of electronic gadget, and the people that will sell them, the Best Buys, the mom-and-pop electronic stores, the online stores that will buy things in bulk, or even OEM manufacturers who don't necessarily want to sell to end users but rather sell to another company. For example, say Walmart wants their own in-house brand of televisions. They can then go to this OEM manufacturer in Taiwan or South Korea and say, I want 100,000 units of a 32-inch, you know, LCD TV.
It can make or break a manufacturer's year.
Yes.
Right there. And then like
maggots
coming to a wound.
Coming media, to a wound.
The media show up.
That's a very...
And start picking over.
It's a very unsavory metaphor there.
But that's true, because the media often perceived as unsavory. However, performing an important purpose. Cleaning the wound.
Cleaning the wound.
You can keep repeating what I say.
Repeating what you say?
We're so freaking brain dead after this.
No, it's... it's interesting because the media traditionally has looked at the CES show as, ooh, what's going to come out in time for Christmas or the summer?
Yeah. It's funny. You get different levels, too. You get, like, on the national network level, it's looked at it like, what's the future going to look like?
Yeah, the future looks a lot like last year with some improvements. which is interesting, you know, segueing into that, there was not a lot new in the sense that, you had the Palm Pre, you had a few other items.
Palm Pre is the smartphone from Palm, which threw away the windowing metaphor, essentially, for a new interface, which kind of got people pretty impressed.
In many ways, I think it's a smart move, because the window metaphor or the GUI that most people are used to on a desktop or laptop computer really doesn't translate well when you have a screen about maybe 4 inches diagonally across.
Right. And this sort of playing card metaphor, which is kind of what I've been calling it, where they just have slides, essentially,
yep.
And then you can flip through the slides. Works pretty well.
Kind of like a Rolodex?
Yeah, yeah.
It's interesting, because a lot of, you know, before the Windows kind of thing, you know, you looked at early DOS shells, they were set up like files, like file folders,
mm-hmm.
And you would access, you know, directories and stuff like that. You didn't have the Windows thing. And it'll be interesting. I mean, you know, what will the future hold in terms of user interface? Because that is pretty much one of the last areas that hasn't been wholly looked at by a group of, or at least, I'm so brain dead. By a bunch of people and say, hey, we need to rework that. Everyone's always taken the kind of desktop PC metaphor as the way it's always supposed to be done.
Yeah.
And then now you have things like, you know, the cross-media bar and the PlayStation 3 people look at, which I still think is clunky, you know, whether you agree with me
Xbox,
or not.
The Xbox.
Blades. They had the Blades.
They've gone from the Blades to a whole different...
Yeah.
I don't even know what to call that now.
It's almost like a rotary dial,
yeah.
Which I like. It's kind of like you have a rotary dial on your... X-axis, and you have one on your Y-axis, which I think works in many cases because you have those two sticks. What I did notice, and I think Tom will back me up on this, was the show was actually felt a lot more empty than it was last year.
Yeah, it was hard to decide Friday. The show started on Thursday, which means it really starts on Wednesday because that's when the media show up and that's when you really start to see a lot of activity. And then Thursday and Friday are the first and second days of the show. That's usually the days of the show when you start, you get packed. People are packed in like lemmings, and it's hard to get anywhere, and the cab lines are incredibly long. And then Saturday, it starts to slide off. And the fourth day, Sunday this year, fourth day of the show is usually totally empty. Neither one of us were even around. I left on Sunday morning.
Which is interesting because Saturday looked a lot like Sunday last year.
That's it. Wednesday was spooky, honestly.
Yes.
Because even though it's only a media day and it's the day before the show's over, usually you're starting to see the cab lines. Usually you're starting to feel a little pressure.
You feel the incoming tide at that point. You feel it. You don't necessarily see it right away, but you get a sense that there's a big push of people.
Because usually folks are starting to arrive,
especially
at the
hotels, the airports.
They're starting to do press conferences. They're starting to have meetings. And it really didn't feel that way. Thursday was the day you started to finally see cab lines. You started to finally, there were people milling about. But I remember Thursday was the day we did the next big thing, Super Session, over in the North Hall. And that's always a slog for us because we have to fight our way from the South Hall of the Las Vegas Convention Center all the way to the North Hall. And usually they schedule something like 10 minutes before. And so we're like in a rush through these crush of people. We made it to the North Hall in like 5 minutes. And that never happens. There just were not as many people there.
So, Tom and I were speculating whether or not this is just a somewhat emblematic of the kind of recession that we're in.
Yeah, I did sort of a lighthearted CNET top five, look at economic indicators, talking about, the quality of the swag, how many ice sculptures there were, stuff like that. But, I mean, it's really true. There were empty booths of two classes, essentially. There was the empty booth, which showed up on the map as empty. In other words, they never sold that, and that's unheard of. The CEA is
Floor space. There was vacant floor space.
Away. That's right. When I say booth, I mean there was floor space where there should have been somebody's presentation, they had never sold it, and that's crazy because they usually are bursting at the seams. The other thing was booths that were supposed to be there. It was on your map said, and the only one I know for sure was American Power Conversion, APC. There was nothing there. You're standing in the middle of an empty space. So then there were people who paid for booths and decided that it wasn't worth it for them to spend the money to actually send people out and set a booth up.
They might have flyers and the thing is, people don't understand, during CES, there's two other trade shows that go along parallel that aren't directly related to the CES, and I mean CES, the actual Consumer Electronics Association, the CEA. That's Showstoppers and Digital Experience.
Oh, those are, like they're press events.
They're press events, but they're not, they have nothing to do either administratively or any kind of...
Aren't they approved by the CEA, though? I mean, because I think I saw them listed in the manual, in the program or something. I think they're sort of cognizant of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they've tried to run them out of town.
Yeah.
And oftentimes they served a useful purpose because they allowed a good amount of overflow that this CES event couldn't handle. And even those events, I mean, traditionally they're either filled to the gills with people who know each other like Tom and I.
Yeah.
And a lot of free eating, people that come in for the free food. And
there still was free eating.
There was free eating, but I went into the Showstoppers. That was Thursday, I believe. Thursday. It was empty. It was I got there, it was 50% empty. Typically, those things are just as jam-packed as CES.
Now, Digital Experience is, I didn't go to Showstoppers this year because we split it up, and Digital Experience was pretty crowded. It seemed maybe a tad lighter than usual.
I think that's because it was like Wednesday night.
But Digital Experience is usually the better of the two shows. No offense, Showstoppers, but that's usually where I get a few more stories. So I don't know. That could be as much economy as people deciding they need to choose. And that leads me to my next topic, which is I think a lot of people came for a smaller amount of time this year.
I think people came for maybe 2 days at most.
Where in the past they would have come in on a Wednesday and stayed through Sunday. This year I think they were coming in on Thursday and leaving on Friday.
Yeah, and someone who's actually had to move everything out on Sunday because you can't get your stuff off the floor until Sunday. They won't allow it. It was very significant in the fact that there was just a lot less people.
The spooky experiences from
the airlines
coming into Las Vegas no cab line at all. This was on Tuesday, so a little bit early. But even when I've come in that early, there's always been a cab line. And we walked up right into a cab. We got to the hotel, and then there was no security line on the way out or the way in the Oakland airport. Walked up,
yep.
Showed my badge. I think there was one person in line.
Take off your
me.
Shoes. Take off your jacket. Take you
in,
know,
in Vegas.
Put your bags
same
in.
Thing. Walked up, maybe two or three people waiting to go through the gate, but not this huge snaking security line like usual.
I think a good chunk of it was overseas press that didn't come because it's expensive.
Yeah,
and. Honestly, I think at this point, there really wasn't – I think a few vendors or maybe a couple of dozen vendors or so thought, like, we're obviously not going to find new buyers in this market. There's no point
showing
off wares, you know, the same wares they know we already have.
Yeah.
And we already have clients. So why don't we try to maximize what we have right now instead of
– There was a lot of talk about that, about vendors really – being cognizant of not putting out some crazy new expensive stuff because they knew they just wouldn't sell it.
Yeah.
And really focusing on the stuff they thought they could actually get into stores.
I mean, right now people are going to be looking at not comfort items, but items they're familiar with, things that they know about. Mm-hmm. So it's
things that they maybe are replacing or minorly upgrading, not taking a chance on some new technology that they don't know whether it's going to fit for them or not.
Yeah. So I think course, it,
and then the Intel earnings came out and cast a shadow over the
and show. Intel's booth is traditionally, and it was this year, a very large affair. So I mean when chip makers, especially Intel, which is they're so big and their products are so prevalent, they're considered a commodity. That just says that corporate America the global IT business is in a downturn because no one's buying new workstations, no one's buying new laptops. Everyone's trying to stretch the existing stock of inventory that they have even further.
And I guess, in general, there's probably tourism is down.
And Vegas.
So Vegas, the lack of crowd isn't all just CES attendance. You're usually jockeying along the strip when you're going out in the evening with a bunch of folks who are there to have a good time.
Casinos were pretty empty.
And all the taxi drivers were saying it's been dead. Even New Year's Eve, they said it was dead. They've been hurting. And so they were looking forward to at least having some people come in for CES.
I don't know. It was just it's we stayed at the Circus, which is a crap hotel. I'm sorry. Just one of those depressing casinos that
I think got a rash from the sheets there once.
You know, those sheets did make me itchy, but I think it's because they use like some weird detergent starch and no fabric softener.
Yeah, I guess saying it, I don't know if she got a rash, but she definitely got itchy.
She was just really scratchy on you, and it's like, you know, when you wash your clothes and you don't add any fabric softener when you clothes hang, it gets really stiff. It felt just like that.
Yeah. Anyway, you could find out what we thought of products elsewhere, but you want to throw out like just a couple notes?
I was really impressed with LeVar Burton.
He was your favorite product? You know he's a real person, right?
I know. I talked to him. We shot an interview with him. So check it out at revision3.com/.
Well, in that vein, I was actually very impressed with Drew Carey.
See?
Which we interviewed him on CNET Live.
Is he still doing the Whose Line Is It Anyway, or is that series?
He's Price Is Right now.
Oh.
He took over for Bob Barker.
He went daytime.
He's a gaming geek.
Oh, no, I know.
And has like 18 islands in Second Life. Huge Second Life player.
Second Life, I guess
kind
parts.
Kind of Warcraft cognizant. He wouldn't admit to me that he played. He said he has a friend who plays that he's aware of. But I kind of got the idea that maybe he played a little bit.
It's just kind of weird when you run into people like that, especially like we ran into Jimmy Fallon at the NBC Universal booth. And he was quite, he's familiar with, Twittering. And, one of his new projects is that web show that he does.
Did you see the? Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead.
Did you see the Panasonic 3D TV?
I did. Saw the line for it. I saw all the literature about it. I did not actually get to go inside.
I went in. This is one of those few times where we took advantage of
the press,
of CNET, and went up and said to the guy, like, "Hey, we're from CNET. Can we cut the line?" And he was like, "They had just won Best of CES in the television category, so they were like, hell yeah, no problem." So otherwise, I wouldn't have had time to stand in line because people were standing in line for hours to go in and see that thing.
Yeah.
And you know, I got up during it and went and stood on the side, was taking off my glasses, and it was basically giving a sort of a double image pattern. And when you put on the glasses, doing some kind of active processing. They said it wasn't active processing, but there was something going on in the glasses that was making the 3D.
It's probably what it's doing is, I mean, typical with LCD 3D glasses like that, it closes off one eye.
Yeah, and if you looked at them when they were sitting on the charger outside, there was kind of like a flicker in the glasses. So I think that's exactly what was going on.
They do that with the 3D IMAX, and it's not a new technology, but it's kind of interesting. Like, for example, NVIDIA was really pushing it.
NVIDIA gave us glasses where it showed the chip in it, and it's doing some calculations. It's not just doing that.
Well, it's doing the calculations on when to shut.
Yeah,
because essentially what they do is they make a 3D image by extrapolating the Z buffer, which in the 3D game that's your depth.
Mm-hmm. X, Y, up and down, Z. Depth.
And it takes that, and then the driver adds additional calculation to say, okay, if the average human eye is roughly, 4 inches apart, 3 inches apart, what part of that image would you see in your left eye, and what part of that image will you see in your right eye? And then since you need roughly 60 hertz for every second to accommodate motion, that's generally seamless in the human eye, it runs at 120, 60 for each eye. And so one shuts for each eye, 120 times, for every second.
And the NVIDIA glasses actually communicate back, and you could adjust the depth. I thought they worked better, frankly, than the Panasonic.
The NVIDIA stuff works well. I do not know, however, in the long term, if you can sit and play like a game for an hour way.
With the Panasonic 3D, they had you in a dark room on a huge screen to show it to best effect. And honestly, I think they may be pushing this technology as much for a theater display as for home use. But I still felt there was a little flicker. I still felt over the 10 minutes...
You got a headache.
When the things came at me, I started to see the double image. The sync stopped working. Never got that with the NVIDIA. Now, over hours of gameplay, I probably would, but I think they're doing a better job of syncing it up so that your eyes don't quite catch on to what's happening.
Having lived through the old interlaced VGA monitors when they first came out and the interlacing... it's stressful on the eyes. Even after a few minutes of just wasn't playing, I was just watching someone play the game with the glasses on, I could feel a little bit in my eyes, a little like sore, and I can tell that it's going to be a highly fatiguing experience. Yeah.
I think everything I've read has said that passive polarization is the better way to do it if you're going to do it with glasses. Problem with not doing it with glasses is you have to sit in exactly the right spot to get the 3D effect. Can't move around. The other thing that was impressive about the Panasonic is I could go all the way to the side of the screen, and I still got a decent 3D effect, just as good as it being in front.
All right, enough flogging CES and Circus.
Yes, let's go to some of the comments that we had on episode 146. Where did I put them? There they are. Well, Kelly was wondering to know about the digital TV switch.
In the U.S.
What I now see on TV commercials asking us to look for and help others with the Switch. Since I've not purchased my digital converters yet, I can't help but feel the deal or deals will be much better days and weeks after the Switch. So the question is, what do you guys think of what I expect after the February digital switchover? Do you think we will see free converter boxes? My other holdout is for better digital converter boxes in 2009. I don't think you'll see free converter boxes at all, especially in this economy. Nobody's going to give them away. The coupon program, where you could get up to two $40 coupons for digital converter boxes
from the federal government,
has run out of money. Yeah. The Congress is going to vote on whether to
extend it,
give more funding to that program or not. Mm-hmm. There's also some talk about delaying the digital conversion, which pretty much everybody is against except Barack Obama and some congressmen. But the National Association of Broadcasters, the retailers, everybody's like, no, we've put so much effort into finally getting people to realize this is happening. Please don't change the
I mean, originally on. It was an FCC push to get it to digital in the first place, and it took, a decade?
Yeah.
I don't think
waiting is the solution. I think you're going to get cheaper boxes. Better boxes, maybe, but it's not going to be a priority for people.
I honestly think that will be... You'll probably see smaller boxes, or you'll see boxes integrated into another device.
Yeah.
However, to say that you'll get better...
To that effect, you can just buy a new TV. The TV will have it built in.
But see, that's my point, is that for a manufacturer, there's really no point in trying to develop a highly evolved, mature product for a legacy platform. Why would I do that? I would sell you might be able to find for $20, but I mean, their solution in the long run is like, buy a new HD TV, you get HD, you get digital, you get analog...
So, Kelly, if you're looking for an excuse to buy a new HD TV, put it this way. You can't get a free box now. You won't get a free box later. If your TV is old and you got the money, buy a new TV.
Yeah.
And if not, wait for to see if the Converter Box coupon program is funded again.
Or,
and then apply for it. You know what? Go apply for the coupon right now, actually. Because the longer you wait, the farther back in the line you're going to get. And they said that they'll fill them on a first-come, first-served basis if they get more money.
And finally, if you have cable TV, that means you get it from Comcast or you don't need to worry about
it. Well, I think he mentioned that he was talking about helping somebody who didn't have cable TV in there. David, responding to our guest last week. Hope you all liked the guest. It was fun having
Klimos.
Having him on.
It's a Klimos.
David said, I live in the shady middle ground between environmental activist and environmental conservative. I think we should reduce emissions and not kill dolphins because it's just the right thing to do and it makes the world a nicer place. Not as a fight against any particular man or for some reason or random cause. I was, however, slightly surprised to find this, and he links to an article in the Telegraph that says 2008 was the year man-made global warming was disproved. I put our grand and supposedly terrible effect on the overall environmental changes on the lower end, not the end, so I find these logics reasonable, if a bit strange. Can anyone do a quick fact check, just a fact check, not an argument, on this stuff? The only possible downside to the downfall of classical extremist environmentalism is that occasionally society needs a poke, and if giving pink slip to all the pokers, who shall poke? However, complaining, rioting, picketing for incorrect or irrational reasons is just wasting everyone's time and is a negative behavior, sometimes on the scale of what protesters are supposedly protesting. And this Telegraph article...
Isn't that an op-ed piece? I remember that being
an op-ed piece.
It's not an actual story.
Column from Christopher Booker.
Yeah, it is an op. It's one of those things where...
And he cites a few facts that the... that the temperatures in 2008 dropped, the overall temperature cooled slightly.
Just to add on that, I mean, most climatologists already worked in there would be a shallow cooling period for the next 15 or 5 years.
The biggest thing I wanted to say in response to this is a really bad rhetorical device that Christopher Booker is using. Which is to say, let's use the most recent data to disprove mountains of data. So if you have 10 years of warming and then 1 year of cooling, you can't say, aha, therefore warming is wrong. Because, you know what? Things go up and down.
Well,
things don't proceed in a linear fashion.
So, what you're saying is don't use relatively, not small data, but data over a smaller period of time versus...
Because I
do believe in using the most up-to-date information.
Absolutely. No, that's a good clarification. But you need to include it, especially when you're talking about climate. Climate changes slowly.
Yes.
Even if man is having an effect on it, it's going to change slowly over decades. So we're talking about the effect of man's emissions over a couple hundred years here. Right, it's not that we just started pumping some CO2 in the air, 5 years ago. Oh, look, suddenly everything's getting warm. We've been pumping CO2 in the air since the Industrial Revolution began.
We've been doing that even before then.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's larger
amounts obviously now than before, but it's been happening forever. So you can't just say like, oh, we had a warming trend for 10 years. Suddenly it's cooler. Therefore, don't have to worry about global warming. That would be idiotic. Doesn't prove that global warming is man-made to say that there's been a warming trend over 10 years.
Yeah.
That is also a small period of time. There's a lot more. It's a lot more complex than that. And that's why this whole discussion gets out of hand and people start picking sides and going on emotional reactions.
Which is actually, I mean, not that I agree with Christopher, but I honestly believe that his particular column is a natural reaction to... And this is what I do not like about activism in the sense of, you know, facts be damned, let's get the warning out there, is that you get to a process where all you're doing is shouting at people,
exactly.
And you're not really having a discussion.
And that's the other mistake that people make in this debate, which is, I don't think people are really buying this, and I'm getting angry, so I'm going to make ever more extreme claims. If we don't do something, the entire coast of California will be flooded. If we don't do something,
you know, that was...
the Alps will melt. And while those may be plausible sort of on the outlier of the bell curve here, what it does is it makes people who aren't inclined to believe you laugh you off and say, well, look, the Alps aren't melting. Well, in fact, the Alps got more snow last year.
Well, no. But see, this is the point, and I think you touched on it, mm-hmm. is that, I mean, it's very much the cry wolf, the boy who cried wolf. If you keep making these exaggerated claims that don't happen, then people say, well, you know, you said this was going to happen and didn't happen. Should I believe you some more? I believe that as long as you keep the discussions intelligent and you back them up with facts, and then when I say facts, not just you know, showing a graph but showing the actual effects, but actually having something that people can measure their own experience with. So you're not doing this detached kind of academic, well, we know better than you, so you better listen to us.
Exactly.
People do not like to be patronized, and people don't like to be, you know, talked down to. If you talk to them like they're intelligent people, people will respond. But if you say that...
Because you get these oversimplifications where a list of scientists come out and say, you know, we think this is happening. We need to reduce emissions by 20%. So what does the other side do? We got our own list of scientists. So then it becomes important to look at who the scientists are. Are they actually climatologists? Are they actually people who are working in the field academically? Because the other thing in that column in the Telegraph, he mentions the Manhattan Declaration. And from my own point of view, the Manhattan Declaration is a bunch of bunk. It was New York City endorsement saying that climate change was not real, that the response was overblown, and that we would do damage to the economy if we tried to stop emissions. But if you look at the people who signed it, they are mostly not climatologists. There are a few, but they're overwhelmingly not. They're chemists, biologists, mathematicians, even some executives at companies. A lot of them are scientists working for private companies. These are smart
people. But I don't just because you work for a private company, even if it is something that might be...
I want to see a nice, fair representation dominated by climatologists, mostly academic.
I believe...
And I agree with you. Just because you work for a company doesn't mean you shouldn't be listened to, but it needs to be balanced.
Yeah, but I also believe that it should extend beyond climatology, because there's so many signs
related
that are
related
fields. So
mathematicians, they're tangentially related. But I don't want to see a ton of mathematicians on there. You know what I mean?
But you need to have
geologists, meteorologists, climatologists, and
ultimately,
there are some on here.
I think.
But the medical officer at the Brown County Sheriff's Office.
Come on, Tom. Haven't you ever been to a sheriff's office?
Is not really. You know, the quality in the large amounts that I expect.
It's a question of credulity. Do you believe what they have to say because of their particular, like if Tom went out and say, yeah, you should invest in, you know, pigeon feathers.
Yeah, seriously. If Roger and I both say, you know, climate change isn't real, you shouldn't believe us.
Yeah.
If we point to things and say, you might want to read this, you might want to read that, that's where we are valuable. We are not climatologists either.
No.
So I'm not trying to be hypocritical and say, don't believe these guys, believe me. I'm saying you should look for better evidence.
And
I'm not even telling you which side to come
on. And I honestly believe that everyone has to make their own mind up.
Yeah.
And I do suggest that everyone learn as much as you can from both sides.
Obviously, there is a limit to what you can learn. You can't,
yeah.
you know,
no,
not
no.
everybody can go to school and become a
climatologist. No, but there is a reasonable expectation of being able to do some homework. I mean,
now I did post a link in response to David in the comments for that last episode to a Wall Street Journal article. Again, I think it's a column from Robert Lee Hotz, which is I just realized it's kind of hilarious. Essentially, talking about the fact
that... Is it Hotz?
Maybe it is Hotz, hopefully. That there was a temperature drop in 2008, and what that actually means, and where you can... what you can interpret from that and what you can't. And this is a really good article, because it doesn't come out and say, you know, don't pay attention to this. We're still, you know, the Earth is going to burn tomorrow. It also doesn't say, see, everything that everyone who says global warming is happening is wrong. It says this is showing the chaos that we're entering into, that there is more variation going on than we expect, and that while we had a overall cooler year, we had record highs and record lows, and we had active hurricane activity, and it kind of touches more on the complexity of what you really do need to look at. Because personally, I do believe that the climate is warming, and I do believe that we have to take some steps to make sure that we don't burn ourselves out. And I think if we're smart, we can do it in a way that makes people a lot of money. And that's where I differ with people who are like, we're going to waste millions of dollars fighting this. I don't think so. I think if we're smart, we're going to actually create an industry around
it. I think part of the problem, and I've noticed that no one has really talked about it at any great length. Everyone's talked about switching over power. They've talked about all these grand, big picture ideas. Mm-hmm. No one's talked about, you know, hey, maybe people shouldn't travel as much as they do, because traveling does use a lot of energy. In fact, some of the more left-leaning environmental groups have come down on imposing a huge surcharge on air travel, discouraging air travel unless it's absolutely necessary.
There was an article in, I believe, it might have been the Telegraph. It was London Times, about the carbon emissions caused by
jet planes.
Google.
Oh,
well, how much carbon was emitted by every search you made simply by using power at the data center.
I actually read a great, this is from Der Spiegel, and generally I tend to reach Der Spiegel with a pretty cautious eye, because I know the way they're right, it just kind of lends me to that belief. But they did a great one on essentially, you know, people talk about technology and things like Google and the internet as relatively non-impactful industries, right? You don't have smoke in the air. Right. But they went out and they say, well, all the energy that you need to run those servers and then run the lines and then have the workers, I mean, it does make a significant impact. And it's one of those things, I mean, you cannot get away from. Any human activity, especially when there's 6+ billion people, will require energy, will output a certain amount of waste, and then, you know, you have to kind of consolidate. You either reduce population, which I think is socially probably.
So you have a modest proposal for solving the climate crisis.
Kill
the young.
Well, that wouldn't really solve anything either, because you'd eliminate the problem 20 years from now, yeah. But you wouldn't have it immediate effect. No, the situation is like, you know, maybe we've been living a lifestyle that we can no longer afford.
I mean,
the thing like, you know, can we afford to have cheap, you know, like $99 airfare round trip from here to L.A.? Mm-hmm.
Is there a better way to power the planes?
That's the thing. It's not just the engines. It's not, you have the entire infrastructure. You have the airports. You have the workers.
Right.
You have the manufacturing costs. But you also have the fact that you have a big metal body in the air. And there has been some research to see, because people think of the air as a relatively
empty,
right? But it's not. It's a fluid. It's composed of oxygen, carbon, nitrogen, and water vapor. So as you have a metal object up high up in the atmosphere in contact with water vapor, you get contrails. You get vortices or little tornadoes off the wingtips of planes.
That's cool. Enough contrails. Maybe we should just fly more planes.
Well, the thing is, they liken this to like a pond, right? The more ripples you add in the pond, you get a lot more chaos. So if you ever look at an air traffic map of the number of planes that circle the planet, can you imagine the amount of, you know, disturbance caused by all these planes?
Let's put it this way. This is an extraordinarily complex issue. The environment is not a simple thing.
No.
Go download an old copy of Sim Earth and play with it. To get a real sense
of
how complex a planet's
ecosystem
is. Not just the ecosystem, but the climate.
Well, that's part of the ecosystem.
It's even more complex when you put that in there as well. I'm just talking about that little graph with the
going
up and down. But yeah, I mean, the whole ecosystem in general is extremely complex. I believe that we are warming. I believe that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere can cause warming. Whether we're causing the warming or not, putting a bunch of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere doesn't help. So it's sort of moot to me at this point, whether we cause the warming or not. We need to pay attention and be careful. even if it's a natural process of warming, to figure out we may have to do geoengineering to cooling, even if we find that carbon dioxide was not, you know, just as a thought experience, if carbon emissions weren't the cause and it's just natural warming and we're speeding it up by adding more carbon, or even if we weren't, figuring out a way to survive so we don't get burned up.
I don't actually, I'm one of those people that's against these big picture projects in that scale.
I don't think you start there.
I think
my only issue with your opinion on this is that it's really on a grand scale. I'm not talking on an individual scale, but on a grand scale, it's hard to make people change behaviors. It's not impossible, but it's difficult.
Oh no! I understand.
So you have to combine it with other ways.
I think ultimately, I mean, the choice will be made for us. I mean, it's not one of those you can opt in or out.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, that's where I agree with Vance about, he says, look, let's do this to save us. Let's not have this rhetoric about like, oh, save the Earth. We're not saving the Earth. The Earth's going to be fine.
Yes.
I am 100% with him on that. I've had that argument for years with environmentalists. Like, you know what? It's fine if you believe in Mother Earth and all that. I respect that. But the reason we need to do this is to save our ass, because the Earth will be okay.
Yes.
In fact, if you take your respective Mother Earth too far, maybe she's right to kill us off. You know, the Earth will correct itself. It's a very hardy ecosystem.
Or,
but it may correct itself by getting rid of the problem if that problem is us.
Yeah, I mean, most immediately, I think one of the potential conflicts isn't just directly the climate itself. It's things associated with the climate. Water scarcity, be able to, grow crops, things that, will affect people in a non-direct manner. So, hey, the prices of my produce have gone up, three times than they were last year, the same season. So it's one of those things where I believe, you can do all these big projects and stuff, but I honestly think that swinging the big hammer at, things like that will not, I firmly believe that will might mitigate some of it, but it won't do enough.
I think
it needs to start at a grassroots, on an individual community kind of scale before. I mean, it's one of those things, education.
I find a lot of hope in that approach in sustainability efforts.
Yes.
Where you start to include the economic costs of all of the behaviors that are not normally included in economic calculations to show, look, it makes sense in a free market to fish the oceans to nothing if you don't count the oceans as a resource.
Yeah.
Once you put a money value on the oceans and you include that in a sustainable economic pattern, then it costs way too much not to come up with a sustainable fishing plan. And just apply that to any other
Then
it starts to encourage those small effects to say, hey, you know what, we can't just, not count that in our equations because it's inconvenient.
Yes.
All right, I think we gave you a nice fat episode.
Fat.
We had a lot more in us than we expected, I guess.
I guess because Tom was so angry about one of the comments.
I wasn't angry.
You were somewhat raging.
I was enthusiastic.
There was steam out of your ears, dude.
There was not steam out of my ears. We can actually promote...
Steam?
If all goes well next week, we hope to sit down with Jonathan Colton.
Oh, physically?
Yeah.
Where at?
I think we're probably see if I can use the CNET studios.
Okay.
So he doesn't have to come all the way over the bridge.
Are you ashamed?
No, I'm not ashamed at all. I just don't want to put the guy out because he doesn't have a car or anything. He's traveling.
You don't want to do what you normally do, just wear your bathrobe.
I don't really know
else?
How he gets. That's one of the things we should ask him, is how he gets from concert to concert. I imagine it's some sort of Partridge Family
bus
situation.
Well, going back, I think it's, we might have to look at new methods or modes of travel as a community, as a society.
Teleportation.
I honestly think we will be all using large animals, towing, large.
Bantas.
Yes.
All right. We'll see you next week, folks.
Bye.